This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
A lot of great writers came out of journalism, and it's another tribe that I belong to. Of course, Hemingway and Stephen Crane, Joan Didion, Tom Wolfe, and more contemporary authors like William Kennedy, one of my favorite writers, The Albany Cycle. A lot of crime novelists come out of newspapers. So it was an amazing training for me. It was a great place to start. And almost from the time I started as a reporter, I was looking for a story that would be big enough to write a book. And with Ruby Ridge, that was the one. And I wrote that book. I kept taking sabbaticals from the newspaper to try to write the book. And I secured an agent, which is the first thing you're supposed to do. And the agent took the manuscript, and I had the first chapter and a half and an outline. That's all I had of the Ruby Ridge book, and sent it to the agent. And he said, this is gonna be great, we're gonna sell this for sure. And I still remember the series of letters that I got back from the agent. The first round was, Dear Jess, we're off to all these editors. This is gonna be so great. I can't wait to see what happens. And then 3 months later, Dear Jess, those were all rejections, but not to worry. Here's the second round of editors. I can't wait. This is gonna go for sure. 3 months later, Dear Jess, we're now out to the third round of editors, the fourth batch. Dear Jess, these are some smaller houses. Some of them, I'm not sure they still exist. There are a couple of academic houses, but don't worry, this is a great book. And then the last letter was, Dear Jess, this is my last day at work at the David Black Agency. And he said the kindest thing, second kindest thing, my new agent is one of my favorite people in the world, but Lev, my agent at the time, said, at the end of this letter, he said this thing I'll never forget, I may have failed you, but your talent won't stick with this. Which, you know, at the end of a letter telling you that no publisher in New York wants your book, still stuck with me as this really generous thing to do. So for the next year and a half, I would send the manuscript out by myself. And then by chance, I was quoted in a New York Times Sunday Magazine piece about something else, and a publisher called me, and I said, as a matter of fact, I have a book proposal, sent it to her, and she called back and said, we'll give you $30,000 to write this book. I didn't have an agent, and so I said, yeah. So, which is not the greatest negotiating ploy, yeah. But that was my first book. Yeah. So, classic rags-to-rags story.
Well, I think there's just, you live in a dreams for so long, like I want to be this thing and do this thing, and somebody finally says, we'll give you some money. Like it could have been $30.
Right.
And the answer probably would have still been, yeah, of course.
Right, yeah. It would have been, yeah.
That's great. And so the book after that was In Contempt, it says with Christopher Darden.
With Jess Walter. I was the with.
That's right, yeah. What kind of process was that? Was that a result of Every Knee Shall Bow, or was it a different?
So when I started working at the Spokesman Review, I'd never been on an airplane even, and I'd never been east of Wyoming when my first book was published. So my first trip to New York was book tour, and not only was it book tour, but this book about Ruby Ridge all of a sudden has become this sort of huge thing. The Senate has announced that they're launching a congressional investigation. It's all of a sudden this sort of huge moment. And my book tour began on Nightline, which I did by satellite. And then the next morning I was going to be on Good Morning America and Charlie Rose. And I'm flying to New York for the first time. I'm so over my head, all for my little $30,000 book. And I came back from that book tour. One of the enduring memories was being interviewed by Sam Donaldson. And my brother calling me on my cell phone and saying, your head is so tiny compared to Sam Donaldson's. I just kept looking like you have the tiniest little pinhead. They would go to Sam Donaldson and then to you. And But it was so surreal being out on this book tour and thinking, this is the dream. This is what I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to be an author, and I had this moment. And then I had to come back to my newspaper job. And I was only there for a few weeks, but I had this sense of being like at a kindergarten desk, like my knees were pressed up against it. I did not want to be there. I was so close to my dream, but you know, you can't live off $30,000 for very long. So my publisher called and said, hey, I just signed the prosecutor in the O.J. Simpson case, Christopher Darden, who was the black prosecutor who was brought in to help try O.J. And he really wants to work with, he has two criteria. He wants a Pulitzer Prize winner and a black woman. And I said, well, I see why you thought of me. I'm the preeminent black woman in my field. So so she said, would you be interested in doing that? And I knew so little about the publishing business, never been to New York, that I didn't even know there were such things as ghostwriters. I assumed we were writing the book together. And so I flew down and I met Chris, and as she suspected, we just clicked. He reminded me of my brother. We were joking. We were playing basketball within a few hours. And I've often thought of writing a play about the two of us living together while I wrote that book in Carson, California. He was a guy who'd grown up in Richmond, very poor, and now for the first time in his life had real money. And we lived in this little crap hole house where he kept buying new furniture and having it delivered. And there was no room for the furniture. And I would say, and we couldn't even see around the furniture, but he was spending money for the first time in his life. And when we negotiated, I said, yeah, I just want my name on the cover. I don't want to, the idea of ghosting someone's book, of writing it without getting credit, didn't make much sense to me. So it turned out to be, it was a way to not have to go back to the newspaper right away and support myself as a writer. And as writers, we have to support ourselves a bunch of different ways. You know, I was in my late 40s before fiction started paying the bills. Before then, it was a really nice hobby that I had. But it wasn't really until Financial Lives of the Poets and then Beautiful Ruins that that I didn't have to do things like the Darden book.
And there were a number of other smaller things, kind of.
I wrote every
things
book
that
in
sort
the world.
Of happened but yeah. didn't happen.
Right.
The Bernie Carrick or some of these other things. Was there a time after maybe In Contempt or before maybe Citizen Vince where? Like investigative, book length, like Joan Didion, who I know is one of your big influences, was sticking with nonfiction an option or something you pursued and abandoned, or how did the transition to fiction happen?
I mean, the big dream for me was always writing fiction. That whole time that I was writing at the newspaper and that I was doing all those other jobs, I was also writing fiction. Not in the newspaper, that would be wrong. Well, there was one story, but it was, I was writing short stories. I jokingly call them manila boomerangs because I would write a short story, and back then you had to seal one envelope inside the other envelope. You sealed your own doom inside the envelope. So you'd send it to the New Yorker with a self-addressed stamped envelope so they could send it back with a rejection.
You even had to pay for it.
You even had to pay for it. Right. You had to double the postage. You had to put postage on your own death notice. And I called them manila boomerangs because I'd throw them out and then 6 weeks later they'd come back to me with a rejection. So for 7 years I was sending out short stories that were getting rejected. I wrote a novel and a half that was never published during that period. So the dream was always to write fiction. Again, I didn't have an MFA. I was self-taught. I was self-teaching myself through that whole process. So I'm not saying those novels should have been published. Most of those short stories, when I went back and looked at them, I saw why they were rejected, partly because I was nobody. You know, there is a sort of, there is a sort of status when a story comes in from a known writer. But fiction was always the thing I wanted to do.
Well, and that you're an anomalous writer in a lot of ways, right? You've already mentioned that you didn't go the traditional MFA route. You don't teach in a writing program somewhere, which those two things all by themselves make you like almost unique in the American literary scene these days. But also you're not hostile to genre, right? Citizen Vince wins the Mystery Writers Award, right? And there's a zombie story in We Live in Water. And if you haven't read the zombie story, read the zombie. It's called Don't Eat Cat. And it's a zombie story.
It is.
Right? So it's there's science fiction and parts of or aspects of beautiful ruins is kind of not conventionally romantic, but there's that sense of epicness to it. And a lot of writers are really hostile toward those commercial genres, and you don't seem to have that. There's also the anomaly of kind of the happy ending in a lot of your stories, that a lot of them, the characters are redeemed, and they do have, I mean, even, Vince Camden goes to prison at the end of Citizen Vince, but that's like a triumph, right? Because it kind of, he's had his moment of triumph at that point, so there are these kind of happy endings. And you're also anomalously just a genuinely nice guy, right? Like, very approachable. Does it begin with the not having gone through the MFA process, these anomalies? Well, really, because the MFA process, it gets a lot of criticism because...
Makes writers into assholes, let's be honest. No, it doesn't.
But it also, there's a lot of exposure to the same kind of teaching and the same kind of writing, and you're largely self-taught or taught through these kind of, master's classes individually with Dan Butterworth or with Sherman or with whomever. I don't know, just talk a little bit about that difference.
I mean, it's hard to know where your traits come from. I think I have a real problem with authority. And so whatever I wrote, I would automatically write the opposite thing the next time. That's just the way I am. I'm constantly writing to get the taste of the last thing out of my mouth. And so I switch genres, I try different things. And I like to think no matter what level of education I attained, I would hopefully be a decent guy. But the thing that strikes me the most is that being open to genre. And I was worried about being pigeonholed as a crime writer. I won't kid you, that worried me for a while because I had success at that level, and it was never my aspiration. My aspiration was just to tell the next story I wanted to read. It's as, really as simple as that. And anything else you do as a writer is in some ways wrong-headed. You just tell the next thing you want to read. You just write it in a way. And it's funny how many of us come to writing through certain genres or certain things, and then we're taught not to respect them anymore. We're taught that they're somehow lesser. And I remember a creative writing professor I had in college telling us, no genre, you couldn't write in genre. And I didn't know what she meant. Isn't everything a genre? What literary fiction doesn't exist in some other genre? Otherwise, is it all just stories about a guy going to a therapist? Is that all literary fiction is? It has to have some genre. It has to have some romance or some suspense. It has to have something, doesn't it? So I think everything automatically crosses anyway. I think the literary world has become much more open to that. Literary writers pass back and forth. I think the culture is becoming far more open to that kind of writing. So I don't think it occurred in a vacuum. But I mean, I honestly don't know. When it's the only path you take, you assume it's a typical path. And it isn't until I get out and meet other writers that I see that it isn't entirely. I mean, I've taught in low residency MFA programs a little bit here and there. I can be a jerk too. So I really belong in the writer club. I promise I do. But I don't know. I don't know. Your own formation is a mystery to you. You can only see out. Other people can see you, but you can only see the world you're looking at. And each book, I've just tried to represent the world I was looking at.
A lot of times, that world gets focused through Spokane. And I think one of the things I've really binged on Jess's writing to prepare for this. So since December or so, I've read the stuff I needed to prepare for my classes, and I've read all of Jess's material. And it's very Spokane-centric. If you haven't read all of it, not all of it is, but Spokane is, if it's not there or named, it's still there. It's still there as a presence and an atmosphere and an ethos. And you grew up around here. You're from mm-hmm. here. You're very intentionally, I think, in the middle of Spokane, in West Central, which is so prominent in a lot of your work as well. Can you talk a little bit about what's being in Spokane and just what Spokane in general has meant to your work and life, I think.
I mean, there's an sort of an entire narrative about Spokane that sort of runs through the work. In one of the early books, I had a character call it the trailer park of the Northwest, and I felt so bad about that. I felt like I had, you know, told people my mother was fat or something, you know. It felt like the worst thing to say. And there's a line in one of the early novels when someone says people in Spokane are always either apologizing for being here or explaining why they're still here. And I think that ambivalence with the place reflected the way I felt in the late 90s especially, as if this was a place that I wanted to escape. When you talk about being an atypical writer, I mean, in some ways, I'm like maybe an 1890s writer who lives in one town, you know, who's married and you know, who... I think in some ways my existence has been the most atypical in the fact that I have always lived in this one place. I dare you to find another writer who's always lived in his hometown. I can't think of any off the top of my head. So there's no way that it couldn't inform the work. Lately, that ambivalence has turned to such a fierce and overprotective love of the place that if I read in Seattle and Portland and somebody cracks on Spokane, I spend the next hour just trying to crush their spirits, you know. So I live in a $230,000 house with an elevator. Oh, well, you know. How much did your apartment cost? Oh, three times that. What's that like? So, the charm of the place was always in the fact that it lacked pretense and that it was real. It was a real place. The things that I felt like it was lacking were culture and great food, a sense that you can do things here. And now I feel the opposite. I feel like the city is at the beginning of this amazing boom. And the people, who, again, you can only see out, you can't see in, so we might be the worst people to see it, but I love when my friends come and say, this place is amazing. I'm too old to experience most of the great things about Spokane now because I don't go out as much as I used to, but I feel like this is an amazing place to be 25. And I know because my daughter is 29 and all she wants to do is get back here. She can't wait to move back to Spokane. And that was not the case for 20-somethings when I was younger. So yeah, I think it's informed the work. I have a severe love for underdogs. The thing you talk about, the endings of books, I do believe in growth and redemption and change. Because I see it, I witness it all the time. You grow up you live in a neighborhood. You grow up in East Valley, where I grew up. You live in a neighborhood like West Central, and you see poverty, and you see people who, despite the fact that they have so many fewer opportunities, still manage to do great things. And it causes you to become a bit of a sap, and to believe in the power of the human spirit, and in people's ability to rise above their station in life, I guess.
What is it? What's happening in Spokane right now? I mean, you've been here and kind of in a unique position in that you've been involved in different kinds of art scenes in Spokane for, you know, 20, 25 years. That all of a sudden there is this just explosion of, you know, Sharma Shields has this, you know, magnificent debut novel that just came out that's getting all kinds of national press, and Sean Vestal wins the Penn Bingham Prize, a national prize for the best short story collection published in a year, and Chris has a novel, and it seems like there's all these amazing writers that have been here or have been struggling, but all of a sudden, just Spokane is kind of just dominating.
I feel like the real thing that pushed us over the top was finally getting a poet laureate myself. So,
I'm like the restrictor plate on one of those race cars.
Yeah. No, it was kind of you not to include yourself in that that great list. No, there. It's funny. I've always thought Spokane is an amazing writing town. I saw Lori Lamont earlier, you know, who has been writing amazing poetry from here. Gonzaga has had amazing people writing there for years. Eastern's MFA program has had great writers. There was a, when I was a National Book Award finalist in 2006, Timothy Egan was a one for nonfiction, who's from Spokane. The next year, Sherman Alexie was a finalist. And I was in New York for the National Book Awards, and the head of the National Book Foundation said, "What is it with Spokane?" And he made the joke at this huge event in New York that there are two literary poles in America, New York and Spokane, Washington. And I mean, the difference was people moved away, you know. Carolyn Kaiser, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet who recently died, famously said of Spokane, "After Spokane, what hell could lurk out there?" And this was the place you left, like a lot of places you leave. Honestly, there's some kid in New York saying, "I got to get out of this shithole. You know, I've got to move to Paris because this place is dead." So wherever you grow up is the place you have to leave. So I don't think Spokane is unique to that, but. I think, you know, the creative writing program at Eastern has been big. I think the growth of the universities. In fact, I made the mistake of calling it Whitworth College. And you know when you see your friend and she's like, "No, it's Mrs. Dr. Johnson now." It was sort of like that. It's Whitworth University. But I feel like the universities here...
All grown up.
And they are not these small, quaint... You know, Gonzaga used to be the place that California parents sent their kids when they were in trouble. You know, that was where the Catholics went to dry out. And it never worked because there was more booze there than, you know. And now Gonzaga is a place, you know, Eastern. The universities, I feel like, are partly leading it. And then there's just this great energy downtown. You know, I see visual artists that, you know, and the food. We talked about the food. You know, it used to be if you went to a restaurant in Spokane and they put a drizzle on your food, it meant that the chef had some sort of health problem. I mean, now, if you get a drizzle on something, it's intentional and it's good. The foodies here are remarkable. And I feel like all this culture, you know, the Magic Lantern reopening, all the gallery spaces, the First Friday, I feel like there's been a sort of push for that. The bicycle trails, I mean, it's all these small things sort of bubbling up together. And there's a tipping point, and we don't exactly know where the tipping point comes. Maybe it was having a poet laureate, but it is a thrilling time. The Spokane Film Festival, you know, in its 17th year, there were always these outposts of writers and artists doing great things here, and I feel like it's caught up to the city in a way. It's caught up to the size of the place, and it doesn't help that artists can afford artist lofts here. If stockbrokers are living in all your artist lofts, it isn't long before your city starts to lose its soul, I think.
We've got an anthropology coming.
Oh, we do?
Aside from that.
So we have lost our soul. I take it back.
What does Spokane still need?
What does Spokane still need?
Or what would you like Spokane to get now?
When I covered the legislature in 1991, they sent me to cover the legislature, I don't know why, for like 3 weeks, and I just kept writing about the bullet train to Seattle, because I so wanted there to be a bullet train, like one of those Japanese high-speed trains that could get you to Seattle in 2 hours. We'll always be remote. It's always going to be hard to get here. In statistical abstract for my hometown, Spokane, Washington, I realized that a lot of the things I didn't like about Spokane had to do with poverty. And that was a great shame to me as a human being and as someone who grew up, as a first-generation college student, to realize that I was such a snob that I hated the town for people like me. That the thing I didn't like about it was its poor white trashness, that the fact that I had called it the trailer park of the Northwest when I am trailer park people through and through. You know, I see one and I think, I love it. Where are the wheels? How do they do that? So So I almost feel like it doesn't need much of anything, especially with this incredible global warming. Thank you, Republicans, because now it's like 75 in February. I got my golf clubs out yesterday. It's I mean, it could use more of the same. It could use great jobs. You know, the reason my 29-year-old, you know, might not be able to come back is that there are fewer jobs here than some places. It could always use more industry. It could always use, but as we live in a gentrifying neighborhood, West Central, there is a block in which almost every house is condemned right now. And that's because the owners are realizing that if they evict the poor people who lived there, they can fix them up and sell them for more money. It's not that they've been, you know, boarded up because the people necessarily did something wrong, although some of them may have. And so what one thing we'll need to do as the city begins to gentrify and as what I think is a sort of golden age of Spokane emerges is to continue to take care of people. One of the things I used to say to people in Seattle is that there's something morally good about a place where a teacher can afford a house. We can't lose that. We have to keep affordable housing for teachers and police officers and sanitation workers and writers, dear God. Although, I don't know if we could get the economy low enough for writers to be able to afford houses. But I think protecting those things that make Spokane great. One thing I love about Spokane is there are still diners that aren't ironic. And as long as we still have diners that aren't ironic, while we have, you know, the places that sort of are, then I feel like we're doing okay.
That's good.
Thanks. Like, yeah.
Non-ironic diners.
Yeah.
It's true, though.
It is true.
You know, I still remember going to the Wall Street Diner with my granddad, and you'd sit at the counter, and he'd have a weird grown-up conversation with this guy he called Cookie or whatever, and just the having the big eyes of seeing the adult world, you know, in a place like that, and the Wall Street Diner is still there. It's still that kind of place, and those places, I mean,
if you worry that Spokane's changed too much, go to Molly's, order the Molly's Mess, and I would do it around 4 in the morning. That would be a good time, and then you'll see all those people you used to be afraid of. They're still there.
They're still there. I think transitioning a little bit towards toward the specific work, one thing I noticed in binging on all your books in the last couple of months is that a lot of your characters are, you can categorize them in maybe a couple of ways. Criminals or these kind of spacey goofballs, right? I think Matt Pryor from Financial Lives is maybe the epitome of the spacey goofball, who kind of just, you know, seems to be floating through, and he makes choices. But let's start with the criminals. I think Vince Camden is such a fascinating character because he's really good at being a criminal. He's pretty slick at it. He knows how to run a scam. And I think of characters like Danny in Helpless Little Things from the new collection. These criminals who are pretty good at being criminals, but still get pinched or popped or whatever. What is the draw to these kinds of maybe fringy characters who end up serving as protagonists for novels or short stories?
So I began my career as a police reporter, and as a novelist, you're looking for conflict. Conflict is the engine of everything you write, and there's no better conflict than crime. I mean, I'm drawn to it. I grew up around some criminals, you know, my cousin stole my bike when I was a kid, and you know, and I committed a few crimes that I'm not proud of, but I'm actually a little proud of them. So I shouldn't be proud of them. But I think more than that, a lot of one thing that I keep coming back to is the idea that there is no them and us. And that's what the title We Live in Water is about. It's all us. We are all. And what we imagine separates us from people doesn't. And so I wanted to write inside criminals not because I'm fascinated in their minds, but because they represent us. And Vince especially is probably one of the closest characters to my heart because he represents that very idea, can we change? Can we redeem? The entire novel is about that question. and about choosing your own symbol of redemption. For him, it's a voting card that arrives. And I was, I have a long history of bike thievery, as you know, and
not of stealing bikes.
No, no, I've never stolen a bike.
Having bikes stolen.
I've had, I think, 8 bikes stolen, 9 maybe. Although I did want to be the guy who stole the police chief's bike. If I'd thought of that, that would have been the police chief, right? The new police chief after he moved to Spokane had his bike stolen, which I just found glorious. So that warmed my heart in some sick way. But yeah, I think that idea that we imagine there are these great differences between us and them, and I don't think there are. I think I connect with those characters in a great way, and there are all sorts of things that are decriminalized that in my world wouldn't be. A lot of the practices of banks, for instance, a few environmental things, and so in some other world, you know, a credit card scam, this credit card scam that Vince runs, to me is no less criminal than the credit card company that used to send my senile aunt credit cards all the time, and she signed up for all of them until she owed them all money, and would fill out anything. Anytime a card arrived, she would just go spend money on it. That's perfectly legal. What Vince does isn't. And I'm interested in those gradations of what we call ethics or morals. And for a character like Vince, I think in the end, what we think of as crime boils down to class. The way he grew up is not the way I grew up or you grew up. And I connected to him in that way because I think class is really the underlying thing. So when I write about criminals, I feel like I'm writing about class.
Well, and there's that moment in that when Vince is at NYU,
yeah,
or in the park,
yeah,
and he sees all the NYU students, and he's looking at them like, they can't be smarter than me. And through the story, we know that Vince is a pretty bright guy. He's reading all these like high-level novels to try to impress this girl, but he's having these reactions like this, and he's having these kind of critical reactions. So
right,
we know that he's a smart guy. He just doesn't. He didn't have. So he's wondering like, what do these NYU students have that I don't? So there's that interesting kind of blurring of those boundaries.
And I sometimes think of that as the most nakedly autobiographical thing I've ever written. Because I was sitting there in Washington Square Park in New York noodling that novel, and I had that sense, I thought. Because I, as a dad at 19, even though I did finish my college degree, I started working 3 jobs. And so I never felt like I experienced college. And certainly not at a high level like I longed to. And so writing Vince sitting there thinking, what do these people have that I don't, that was pure transference of my anxieties onto a fictional character.
So moving through, from Citizen Vince, we go to The Zero, is the next novel. And I think that in the 3 novels after Citizen Vince, we see this kind of ramping up of maybe large thematic kinds of forces in the novels. The Zero is in many ways about America's response to the September 11th attacks and the kind of commodification of fear that took place in the aftermath there. Financial Lives of the Poets about the recession and how it affected people and the kind of great mythology that we had created of financial security. And Beautiful Ruins just kind of being epic in almost every way, in time, in character development, in everything else. It was always interesting to me too, reading reviewers for Beautiful Ruins would say some version of, this book is nearly perfect, it's near perfect. I'm like, what are you looking for? Like, this book has it all. What is the perfect book? But I guess that's the critic can't
right,
say that
right,
it is the perfect book, because yeah, that's the end.
Well, and I would quit too, so yeah.
But so there's this kind of increasing scope to them, but also an increasing level of maybe satire or commentary on these kinds of cultural forces that are at work in America these days. And I wonder where that inclination comes from and how you work that into a given narrative.
I thank you, and I think that's a great observation. I do feel like the novels have become more both more topical and more interested in kind of the aphorism, in almost a synthesis of the world as it's occurring. And when we develop our voice as a writer, a few things happen. One, we grow older and hopefully wiser, and I think that happened. But I also think I became challenged by these larger themes, and I don't know. Each book contains itself. So once you start a book, it becomes the thing it has to become. The Zero, when I'm, you know, which was the most difficult book I've ever written, and nearly broke me in some way, because it was so profoundly about grief. It's also surreal. It was difficult to kind of keep my arms around. I kept feeling like the whole thing was just going to explode and splatter me against the wall. But I also had a real sense that I was saying something that needed to be said. There's a line about fiction that great fiction names something that hasn't been named before. And I felt, as I was writing that, as if I am writing about that commodification, about a sort of post-traumatic break from reality that we suffered as Americans after the 9/11 attacks, and that I have a vessel for doing that that makes a kind of narrative sense. And so it was terrifying and thrilling to write the whole time. With Financial Lives of the Poets, that came out of... I would always describe my books as funny. I'd say, oh, this one's funny. And my wife, who's a tremendous reader and a wonderful person, said one time to me, you always describe your books as funny. They're not that funny. And I said, they're not? And it was sort of like, you know that jacket you always wear? It doesn't look good on you. I was like, this jacket looks great on me. Everyone looks at me. And so I said, oh yeah, I'm gonna write one that's funny. And so I wrote Financial Lives of the Poets, really trying, after the exhaustion of the Zero, trying to make myself laugh. And I gave it to her and she said, this is the least funny book of all. So, no. But again, that book kind of became itself, and it became a sort of anxious descent that it's so full of anxiety, and the author's sort of, again, transferred anxiety onto this character who, as you say, makes all sorts of horrible mistakes. And then with Beautiful Ruins, because I wrote that over 15 years, I think it has the benefit of time. You know, if you can imagine working on something that long, the perspective that you gain allows you to say things. You know, I remember writing around certain things, and I think if I've evolved as a writer, sometimes I just come out and say them, you know. And I found myself doing that with We Live in Water. I would reach these points where Wheelbarrow Kings, one of my favorite stories, I'm writing about these two guys, these meth heads who have this odyssey, adventure after adventure, and it's just one awful thing after another. And then at the end of it, they're telling the story, and they start laughing. They're laughing so hard, and we've all experienced that, where we've gone through something together, and when we tell the story, all of a sudden it's the funniest thing. No one else would think it's funny. And these two guys are laughing the way my brother and I would laugh about a car accident, you know, which in hindsight is so funny because this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And then one of them says to me as I'm writing, you know, it's funny, we didn't laugh the whole time we were doing this stuff. I guess remembering is better than living. And it just hit me, you know, and it hit me in that empathetic way too, that these two guys, that for these two guys whose life is trying to score a $12 hit of meth, that that for them to say that had even more meaning and power. And so the freedom to just be able to write a line like that instead of circling around it fictionally feels like this great gift. And now I have to be careful that I don't just go straight to the aphorism, that I don't just go straight to the line and not, you know, my next book of short stories might all be one sentence long, you know. So. Yogurt makes me feel funny. Next story. Yeah.
Returning to the Zero for a minute, you said that it was so difficult to write, and if you've read the Zero, you might have, you might recognize some of that difficulty. It's a difficult book to read.
Ouch.
I kind of worked backwards. So I'd read Financial Lives and was like, oh, this is, you know, fun.
Yeah.
And then the zero is just like, when's the fun going to happen?
Yeah.
Oh, there's not going to be any fun.
No.
And it makes sense that there's not. But stylistically, it's a real difficult book as well. And just maybe talk a little bit about the process of, if you're not familiar with the zero, the narrator, the main character, Brian Remy, has these kind of blackouts and these gaps, he calls them. So each section begins in a place that Remy doesn't know how he got there necessarily or what he's doing, and kind of develops this reputation throughout the novel as this kind of hard-dealing guy, because he's always, somebody will ask him something and he'll just repeat the question and they think that he's being tough or difficult, and he honestly has no idea what's happening.
It's funny that it sort of bridges from Citizen Vince, because it has the framework of a detective novel, but the thing he's investigating is pure absurdity in a way. And I was at Ground Zero on another writing assignment, another ghostwriting job, and I was there 5 days after the attacks and spent a few weeks there, and was at Ground Zero the first few days giving out granola bars and searching for bodies and gathering shoes and doing all sorts of kind of insane things. And it was harrowing and everything you could imagine. It broke my heart in, you know, a thousand different ways. But I remember coming home and driving home, landing at you know, I was home maybe a day, and I was driving up Division, and there was a sign that said, God bless America, new furniture arriving every day. And I pulled off to the side of the road and just burst into tears. I felt Remy-like. I felt like, what could that possibly mean? How did we get from this to new furniture arriving every day? And if you remember the weird sort of consumer nationalism, if we don't drink Budweiser, the terrorists have won, you know? It was insane. And that post-traumatic break from reality wasn't insignificant. It had us invading a country that had nothing to do with the attacks. It had more than 50% of Americans believing Iraq had something to do with the 9/11 attacks. It led to the world we live in today. ISIS comes directly out of the unrest and that began with the invasion of Iraq. So that sort of world, I felt as if our cause had been broken away from our effect. And the only way that I could imagine writing fiction is the personalization of those larger forces. And so I created this character, Remy, who has what he calls gaps. His cause is separated from his effect. He'll reach out to open a doorknob, and his hand will close around a glass of whiskey instead. And he'll look around, and he'll have to imagine, like, how did I get here? And he becomes so good about bluffing for me, that was where the fun came from. You know, he could imagine. He's standing in a bathroom. He's naked. He looks down. He has a half erection. Did I have sex, or am I about to have sex? And then a woman says, are you coming? About to have sex. And then he thinks, I don't know her name. And he opens the medicine cabinet and sees her name, and he's like, there are a lot of medications in here. Maybe I don't want to do this. And all those, it became an interesting device, and I knew the novel would work when it became not just about 9/11, but about the way we live our lives in general. We take a phone out. No one knows how this thing works, and yet we use it. There are gaps in our everyday experience that are very similar to that. His son... Remy's son is convinced that his father died in the terrorist attacks. And nothing that Remy says will convince his son that he didn't die. And when he tells him, his son says, I can't believe you would even say this. What if I was living in Wyoming? Would you argue about my ability to grieve what happened to America in Wyoming? Then why are you telling me I can't grieve the death of my father just because you're alive? And his mom's like, he's right. And and that sort of disconnect with your kids felt universal and real. And if you have kids, you know that the minute they turn about 14, they give you this look like, are you still around? I thought you died years ago. And so again, when this device became more than device and became something universal about the way life sometimes feels, I felt like the novel was on the rails, I guess. And it is difficult to read. This woman called me one time, and I answered the phone. She said, "Is this Jess Walter?" I said, "It is." She said, "I'm 86, and I'm in a book club, and we're reading your book, The Zero, and I don't understand a word of it." And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry." And she said, "Yes." I said, "Well, you know, it's a kind of Kafka-esque book. It has these breaks from reality. And I think if you read Remy as a sort of allegorical figure, standing in for all of America, then, unless as a strict narrative figure, I think then the novel will make more sense." And she said, "Yes, I didn't get a word of that either." And she said, but I think your book is about 7-Eleven. And I said, do you mean 9-11? And she said, "Oh, yes, I'm sorry, you're right." And I said, "Well, you're right, it's about 9-11. And she said, "Well, thank you, you've been so kind, and which of your books would I like?" And so after we hung up, I thought, I want to write a book set in a 7-Eleven store. And so the very next novel, The Financial Lives of the Poets, begins in a 7-Eleven store.
Well, there's even some slippage in that novel.
Yeah, there's
the next 7-Eleven or another 7-Eleven.
Right. The character in that novel keeps saying, "I hope there won't be another 7-Eleven." And every time he goes to the 7-Eleven to get high and buy a burrito, of course, he thinks, if only his mother knew that's what she was talking about. So, yeah, in some ways, like I said, I'm always writing to get the taste of the last book out, but there's a sort of call and response sometimes within the books, too.
Well, so that gets us to the most recent, which is a collection of short stories. So, again, kind of career-wise, you did it backwards, where a lot of, young writers will write a thesis, and the thesis leads to a collection of short stories, and then the short stories lead to a novel. And so you start, of course, with novels, and now you've got six novels in a collection of short stories. So how did that come to be, and why bring this book out now? Though there are, kind of novelistic elements. You've got these kind of vignettes that keep recurring and these characters in them, in Breaks and Can of Corn and some of the other ones, where these characters kind of come back, but it's... maybe just talk a little bit about structure in the short story as opposed to the novel and what this book is doing.
Finding out tonight that I've done everything wrong as a writer, it's sort of dispiriting. So I thought I'd been doing pretty well, but I was writing short stories, as I said, the whole time, and I had published dozens of them by the time my fifth novel, The Financial Lives of the Poets, came out. And so when my agent, when I gave him Beautiful Ruins, I said, I'd also love to finally publish a book of short stories. It would be a dream of mine. For me, the dream of being a writer began with short stories. And to have finished Beautiful Ruins, which I worked on for 15 years, and then to see a book of stories, which I worked on for 25 years, felt like some real sense of circling back around and completing this project I'd started. The stories themselves, as I was saying it earlier tonight, for me, story collections come in two kinds. I relate everything to 1970s rock music. So you either have a best of album or a concept album. And with We Live in Water, I really wanted it to be a concept album. I wanted the stories to tie in some way. And I had begun, I was tutoring at Holmes Elementary and meeting kids who don't have the opportunities my kids have, and I was, during the recession especially, seeing, great poverty around me. One night, my wife and I went to dinner, and a woman stopped us on the street, and we were really close to a liquor store, and she said, "Can I, I've been kicked out of my house, my husband beat me up, and I need money for my three kids to buy them food." And we were so close to a liquor store that I was pretty sure that the $10 I gave her was going to go for booze. But for some reason, I gave it to her. And Ann and I talked about it at dinner. It's like, I wish I had a policy. When do I give money? When do I don't? And we were both sure that she spent it on booze. And it was shocking to look up and see her walking down the street carrying two bags of groceries followed by three kids. And I just had this moment of, I just thought, I used to be a much more empathetic person. And one of the things that I sort of dislike about America, about the state that I feel like we're in now, is we blame people for their own poverty. We assume they've made some mistake, that they've done something wrong. Ask most Americans and they'll put themselves solidly at middle class, no matter where they are. And the people below them, maybe we have less empathy for. And I was researching, and I'm still researching, a novel set earlier in our history, and during the Great Depression, for instance, when 1/4 of all men were out of work, and women weren't even in the workforce. And so you can imagine how few people were working. We didn't necessarily blame people for poverty, which feels to me like hitting someone with your car and then blaming them for the dent. And so the whole collection started to form itself around this idea of empathy, and very much like the stories I wrote about crime, not writing about them, but writing about us, writing about these people as us. I'm not that far removed from, you know, from a dad who was laid off from Kaiser, and you know, eating generic food, and you know, and so it's not that hard to find in our own past, certainly, you know, times of poverty and want. And so that's sort of how the stories structure themselves. When I collected all those stories and put them together, I knew two things. One, I wanted a zombie intermission in the middle, and I could come up with several ways to include zombies in a sort of underclass. And so that's what that story, that's how the story made its way there. And then I wanted statistical abstract for my hometown, Spokane, Washington, to be the last piece, because I felt like it reflected back on the others. I described it earlier, it was like you spend all this time in a sort of fictional room, and then you open the window to see the real world on the outside. So that was sort of how they structured themselves. I have a whole lot of funny basketball stories and heartwarming stories and stories from the point of view of women, and none of those made it into the collection. It was all these hard-bitten men stories. But I remain really proud of it. You know, to have started writing short stories in 1987, 86 probably, and then have a collection come out in 2013 feels to me like some sort of triumph of stubbornness at the least.
So these basketball stories.
Yes.
Maybe this is from a format perspective. I've been asking just questions. I'm going to give you guys an opportunity here in a couple of minutes to ask questions as well. We'll do that, and then we'll do some book signing. So the end is approaching for those who are worried. I have these just a realm of questions surrounding basketball. One, and you can pick whichever one you want to answer. One is, you've got this great podcast, Tiny Sense of Accomplishment, that you do with Sherman Alexie, mm-hmm. And mostly you talk about basketball. And it strikes me that these two kind of really great American writers who created this podcast, and I would imagine the agents were involved, and they were thinking, look at these great American writers to talk about writing, and all they talk about is basketball. but that in my experience, basketball is one of those weird sports where the players never stop playing. They keep playing no matter how old they are. Jim McPherson couldn't be here tonight. He wanted to let me know because he's in a rec league and he has a game tonight and he didn't want to miss it.
He sent me an email. And Dale like Soden as well.
Yeah, Dale as well. You know, my pastor is Rob Fairbanks, who you know, very connected.
He's a baller, yeah.
Sherman.
I would never
Chan.
Trust a pastor who shoots that well myself. So.
Guys like Shan. Yeah. What is it about basketball that one, you never stop playing no matter what? I think of your character, I think Cole in Bleacher Couch Hero. Bleacher Couch Man. And these guys are putting on they're like turning themselves into robots in order to play this game. They need so much gear to hold themselves together. But maybe the joy of basketball or the addiction of it that you still feel.
You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be two things. I wanted to be a writer, I wanted to be a novelist, and I wanted to be a professional basketball player. And those were my two great goals. And I have to tell you, when I was 15 or 16, I thought basketball was a more likely path for me. I really did. And it wasn't until my senior year we were doing a drill, and I kept thinking, I'm gonna blossom any moment now. I know I've been on the bench, but we were doing this drill, and we had to point. First of all, you had to keep your feet moving like this, and then you've got to point to the two guys on offense. And so I'm doing this, and I'm looking back and forth, and my coach said, stop turning your head. And I said, well, I can't see that guy if I don't turn my head. And he said, well, look out of your other eye. I said, I can't see out of this eye. And he gave me this look like, I have a one-eyed point guard? And which had to be so horrifying for him. I mean, and I actually read in a book a phrase as worthless as a one-eyed point guard. And so I totally disconnected from me, not even knowing. And so the fact that I ever thought I would be good at that game, but again, a sort of resilience, I guess. Earlier this year, I broke 4 bones in my face playing basketball. And I have had so many stitches in my face. It's Frankenstein has had fewer stitches in his face than me. So, and I just keep playing. I mean, it's a beautiful game. It is pure athleticism. It is, it has a flow to it. It has a rhythm that's very much like writing. When you're in the zone, when the jumper's falling, and you feel like a conduit, there are times when the ball doesn't even seem to touch my hands. It's just out and it goes in. And it's so much like the zone writing. It feels, and Sherman and I will talk about this, you know, and thank God I can get in more zones writing. My streak shooting in basketball is much less. But it's to this day, I went to the YMCA and played today. I have, since breaking my face, I'm trying not to play in as many actual physical games. So I've developed a game where I go shoot 250 jump shots at full speed back and forth. It's because if I ever get another game, I'm going to be on fire. I'm going to be ready. They're going to be like, where's Jess? What's Jess been doing? Because the ball is just going to fall. But just even today, I was doing that, and they just started going, and the zone came again, and everything started working together in this sort of concert of physical, you know, almost spiritual release where you could feel it all going, and then I tore my hamstring. No, I didn't. But yeah, it's I try other kinds of exercise. I sort of ride a bike. My wife took me jogging once, I've never found anything that makes me feel. I've never found an athletic activity that makes me feel alive as basketball. And we have a basketball team. A literary basketball team called the Spokane Dirty Realists. And Sherman, Alexi, Shan, Ray, me, we always recruit ringers when we play. So one game we had David Pendergraf, and then we came in to play Whitworth, and we brought not only Pendergraf, but Calvary and another big guy from Gonzaga, Corey Violette. And but Whitworth was waiting for us. They brought the whole team out and killed us. And your coach can shoot. Man, there's no wonder your team is so good. That guy lit us up. And Dale Soden gave some sort of runner that shot from his hip. You can't block that shot. You can't get your arms low enough. He was hitting these runners. He was hitting these 1950s hook shots. He kept trying to take the ball out of the peach basket. And we said, no, you don't have to do that anymore. But anyway, so Whitworth has given the Spokane Dirty Realists their only defeat, and we're still sort of stinging over it. So.
There was a rumor that there was a book of basketball stories that you and Sherman had written back and forth. Is that?
That was always the plan, that we'd write these two rec league teams. So mine, rec league with a W, W-R-E-C-K. And they're really stories about male aging, but they're stories about rec league basketball players. And then in the last story, we'd write it together. So we'd alternate stories, and then the last story would be these two teams playing in a tournament somewhere. But we have a lot of plans, you know, where I've written 4 of my stories. I think he's written 2 of his. And we have no idea how these two teams would play. The styles are so radically different, but it might still happen.